Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. We are obviously spending a lot of time watching what's going on in Iran, in Israel, throughout the whole Gulf region. And right now, I'd like to talk about the whole concept of international law, because we're hearing a lot about this here at home, that the war violates international law, that some of the strikes violate international law. We have NGO Monitor President Professor Gerald Steinberg with us. He's coming to us from Jerusalem and taking time out of his busy day, and not to mention the current threat profile that we're seeing aimed at Jerusalem and Israel more generally, to talk to us about international law, what that actually means, and how it does or does not apply to the circumstances. So, Professor Gerald Steinberg, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Ed, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to your audience. The programs you do are very informative, and it's an opportunity for me to explain some of the things I've been doing. I've been teaching international politics in Israel, mostly in Israel. I got my degree in the U.S., but came here over 40 years ago. And I've been teaching international politics skeptically, especially negotiations, international negotiations, and international law became part of that over the last, let's say, 20, 25 years. Skeptically, because I think a lot of what passes for academic insights is really somewhere between myths and common sense, common knowledge. But one of the things that I began to focus on, one of the areas that I really began to look at, was the way that the concept of international law, the language, the word salads, I'm going to put it straight out there. I think a lot of this is just word salads, that began to be used about 20, 25 years ago, primarily as a weapon against the West, against democracies. A lot of the people are what academics call post-colonialists. The West is guilty of having captured, having colonized and stolen all the minerals and everything else from the East, from the countries sometimes called the Third World or the Global South. And they don't have to keep international law because they're victims. And they created this whole construct. Now, I'll just say from the beginning, before we get into the specifics of how it's being used against Israel and the U.S. in this war, just to say that, you know, there are two international courts out there, both of which are political, both of which are essentially created and run by United Nations, or by a conglomeration of countries, most of which are not democratic. If you have courts and you have police, you have prosecutors, and you have a legal system in the United States, it's part of the democratic process. And yeah, there can be arguments and there are hearings and this judge or that judge, but it's built into the American democracy, just as in other democratic countries, the legal system is one of the three branches and it's built in. International law has no legitimacy. There's no international legitimacy unless you want to say the United Nations, the majority of which the countries are not democracies.
Right.
You've got all sorts of dictatorships and tyrannies and other things. So the very concept that there's something called international law that restricts the ability of countries, particularly to defend themselves, is just a facade. And I started to talk about that and write about that about 20 years ago. A lot of people hate me for doing that because
I'm not one of them.
Okay, well, that's why I'm here. They wouldn't give me a platform, right? That's part of it.
No, I mean, I would be just as happy to interview somebody who is telling me, you know, that international law is a real thing and here's the reasons why we're violating it, because I think it's an interesting argument. I think it's an interesting debate, but that's not going to be this kind of that will not be the conversation today, because I completely agree with you that there are ways in which you can construct international norms. But I would argue that you can really only do that bilaterally between two different nations. And in the United States, that has to be in the form of a treaty that is passed into a quasi-law status by two-thirds of, I think it's two-thirds of the Senate has to.
It's not quasi, it's law. When the United States passes the Senate approves a treaty and the president signs it, that becomes part of U.S. law. But U.S. never agreed to join the International Criminal Court, for instance.
Right.
Unlike other countries, Europeans and others. You know, there's another aspect I want to bring in here, and that is this idealist, hope is policy type. Okay, we can outlaw law particularly after the Second World War. There was a little bit of us after the First World War, but it became a major movement after the Second World War. We're going to bring peace by outlawing war, or certainly certain kinds of weapons and certain types of tactics. And that's all very nice, except how do you get countries like Russia, China, how do you get countries who are aggressors? Now we see Iran. You know, every time Iran fires a missile at Israel, I'm sitting here and you can hear the booms. Fortunately, not where I live, but where other people live.
Right.
They've gotten impacts. People have been killed. Well, those weapons, some of them are cluster bombs. So they break up in midair and they scatter and they're aimed at civilians. That's a war crime. Or yeah, in,
exactly.
But nobody enforces it. And you don't really have to enforce it, they tell us, because these are victims of the West. And they're not, they don't quite make this argument straight out. But if you read, take a group like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, which claim to be the voices of international law, sometimes it's called international humanitarian law to distinguish it from economic law and other things. But the law of war, when you only write reports saying how bad the U.S. is and how bad Israel is, and even Amnesty and National wrote a report saying Ukraine was committing war crimes. Now that's absurd when they're being invaded by the superpower Russia. All these things. And they're putting rockets when Iranian proxies in Lebanon, Hezbollah, puts thousands and thousands of rockets in people's houses and schools and hospitals and clinics. Well, that's what Hamas did in Gaza.
Right.
Nobody calls those war crimes. But that's exactly what they are. But they don't. It's a double standard.
It's a double standard. It's double standard hypocrisy. But there's a fundamental principle here, I think, in play that never appears in international law. And I really do want to put scare quotes around that. And I think that you probably appreciate my impulse to do that, which is reciprocity. And this is what you're getting around, is that if you actually have a legal system in place, right? You actually have a system of law. It's the reciprocity, it applies to everybody, so it's reciprocal. If one side does it and it's illegal, the other side doing it has to be illegal as well. And there has to be an enforcement mechanism that adjudicates that. Now, if you don't do that, what you have is not a system of law. What you have is a system of taste, and you have a system of preferences. And that's not law. That's something entirely other than law. And
well, I'll give you, I agree with you completely. There are two phrases, two terms, definitions that small group of us that have been critical. And there are other people out there who do this. Some of them, even in a few law schools, not very many, they're ostracized too. But the terms lawfare and weaponization of law, those are very important. So you use war, you use law, not in order to adjudicate, not to create a system of reciprocal, I haven't spoken that English in a while, reciprocal obligations and requirements. Everybody goes through the same legal process. Everybody can be liable, send the same sentences, found jury of our peers, or in some cases not, whatever it works out as. But it's, yeah, it's reciprocal. There's none of this in international law. It's all political. The prosecutors, the judges, many of them are diplomats, they're members of the regime. They don't have any connection to a fair legal process, but that's how it works. So the idea that there's something called international law, law of war in particular, and that it's used across the board, it's just, it's a fantasy. It's more weaponization of law. We don't want you, we're against your actions. We don't want the United States to be bombing Iran, even though Iran's building nuclear weapons, which, by the way, is, of course, an entire basic violation of international law. They signed treaties.
They signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which we can talk about, too, because I know you're an NPT expert as well. Yeah.
It's all part of the same package. But if there's no enforcement and you sign agreements like Obama and then Biden that say, OK, well, you violated the rules and you've started to build nuclear weapons, so we're going to let you slow. We're going to tell you to slow it down for 10 years, but then you can have nuclear weapons. Well, that's not a law-based system. That is completely the opposite of that, which is being threatened and coerced into accepting what is basically a violation of law. So you have all these aspects going on. And, you know, I hear, and you probably see the same thing, you hear, whether it's commentators on media who quote, what are called respected international organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and others, or you have a UN official saying, well, this is a violation of international law. And you look at it and there's just nothing there. It's just, again, empty words that they use. And that's a major part of the problem, but it gets echoed. There's this big echo chamber and everybody repeats it and it becomes a fait accompli in some ways. It's self-enforcing with no substance. It's like the Wizard of Oz.
Well, and but basically allows people, critics, to claim that somebody's a war criminal when they really have no idea what that term means. And it doesn't apply. I mean, this is not the type of situation in which it applies. This was a pretty clear run-up. Nobody was surprised in either of the two, either in the June, 12-day war, or in this particular conflict. There was attempts to negotiate. There were offers made. The buildup was very obvious. It was so obvious that everybody was writing about it in the 7 weeks that led up to this particular conflict. And it started, what prompted it, didn't start. This thing started 47 years ago, but it was prompted in this case. The catalyst in this case was an actual crime against humanity, was the massacring of 32,000, at least 32,000 Iranians in the streets who were protesting against their government. They're still executing people to this week, at least, who participated in that. There was a young woman whose name and face went around as being the latest to be executed for those protests. So the idea that somehow the normal mechanisms of war amount to a violation of international law is basically, I guess the best I can put this, Professor Steinberg, is it's a fantasy. It's this sort of fantasy.
Well, I'd make
that
it stronger.
Yeah.
I'd say stronger. First of all, just as a side comment, but there is one of the basic principles back about 75 years ago when you had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. After the Second World War, there was this great optimism. The United Nations would pass these declarations. And they would be, it would almost maybe not outlaw war, but set rules and regulations for war. And then you had all sorts of other things that came afterwards. But those were all, they were based on fundamental moral principles, which you don't have here. And it also had this caveat that said non-interference in the internal affairs. So actually invading Iran because the government killed 30, 40, who knows how many people, was not a claim that was made under international law, but it is a claim that can be made under morality. And when you have tension, when law and morality don't go together, you've lost it. You've lost the fundamental basis of justice and justice and law, which is there in order to promote morality. But I would go to a second aspect of this, which is you have this big chorus, and you hear it from members of the Senate, Elizabeth Warren and others, it's all predictable. And what they say is, and of course, they're all quoting Human Rights Watch and all these great experts, none of which are really experts, but they have a lot of money.
Right.
And they say, well, here's the rules, right? You can't, the war had to be imminent, that you had no other choice, right? Are you laughing?
I'm laughing because this is the dumbest argument ever. You have to wait until you get punched in the nose.
Yeah, what does it mean, imminent? You got a country, a dictatorial regime, that has acquired thousands of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And we're seeing them flying, not just against Israel, plus all these drones and other things, but against the UAE, against various Gulf countries all over the place. Even fired one at U.S. base in Diego Garcia, which is, I think, a 3,000-mile.
Yeah, I think 2,400 miles. It was twice the range that Iran admitted it had. So clearly they can hit Europe, pretty much the entirety.
Right, Europe's in target zone. So when do you decide that a war is imminent? What do you have to wait for? Do they have to say, hey, we're going to declare war and start launching these rockets in 3 weeks, so get ready? That idea that something is imminent, after it's been going on, you said, for 47 years. We had the war in June. We saw the capabilities there. All those things were well known, were well practiced. So to say that this war is illegal because it's not imminent is completely absurd. You got to wait. What it really says is, wait till you're attacked. Wait till you're committing suicide. Let's do Pearl Harbor to quote from the president in a recent discussion with the yes. Japanese prime minister. Right. Let's wait. And that was actually an interesting exchange from the substance. I won't get into the diplomatic faux pas or not. But the fact that the journalist, the reporter said, why didn't you announce it in advance? And Trump said, well, you know, if we would have, you didn't announce Pearl Harbor, but you don't fight a war, good or by bad, by telling your enemy what you're going to do next. And especially right. if this is a just war against a regime that has been violating every moral principle you can think of for dozens of years, you're not going to say, oh yeah, you know, we're going to give you one last chance. Actually, the president did that in the negotiations. And then we're going to strike everything that we can hit. So this concept of a war has to be imminent and there's no other choice is it basically that, look, a lot of these people who like international law, who embrace international law, they want to, their stated goal is to eliminate war. They want to change the human race to, by eliminating war, right? We've got how many hundreds of thousands of humans, and war goes all the way back. And it has lots of reasons for it. But they thought, we're going to legislate. We're going to have this legal system that's going to prevent war, but we're going to apply it only on one side and not the other. And the absurdity just screams out there.
Well, I would call it unilateral disarmament, is what I think is what they're aiming at. And that's been the case, by the way, for decades.
Yes.
You can go back to the 1980s with Ronald Reagan and the Pershing Missile Crisis in Europe. Basically, what they wanted was unilateral disarmament and just trust the Russians that they led their children, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a whole series of nonsense. I do want to talk about the imminent thing, because I think that this argument rests on both a misunderstanding of international law, but also a misunderstanding of American law, of U.S. law, which is the War Powers Act, which is going to be, it will never be settled because neither Congress nor the executive branch will ever want this to be settled. It's one of those ambiguities that just allows everybody to sort of get away with just enough and not quite too much so that nobody really wants to have a settlement of this. But the idea is that the president can order military action if he sees a clear and present danger. It's not an imminent danger. It is a clear and present danger. And what you're seeing, I think, in the United States, at least, with all the talk of imminent, there's no legal basis for imminent. There's a legal basis for clear and present. And Iran has been a clear and present danger to the United States, again, for 47 years. They kidnapped our diplomats in November 1979. They through their proxies, they murdered 240-something Marines in Beirut. Yeah, the IRGC has directly attacked American forces in Iraq and other places in the region. This, and of course, the death to America chants and all that, and the development of nuclear weapons in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Again, you're an expert in that, so you know what that means. It's a clear and present danger. It's always been a clear and present danger. It's just that this particular president has decided that it was too clear and too present at this particular time to allow it to continue. So there's no illegal basis for initiating hostilities here. We can argue wisdom. We can argue, you know, what's the end plan here. There's lots of things that we can argue, but legality really isn't one of those things. This is not, the legality really doesn't enter into it. It's not in an international sense and not even in a domestic sense here in the United States.
You started talking about the War Powers Act, and that goes back, I don't know, 40 years or something like that?
50 years. It was, I think it was in Nixon's administration.
Yeah, Gulf of Tonkin and Vietnam, something that
resulted. Yep. Yeah, it was a reaction to that. Yeah, a reaction to the Gulf of Tonkin is what it was.
But you had in those days, in Congress, you had responsible leaders on both sides of the aisle, and they had briefings and very careful analysis. You had Henry Jackson and other Democrats who were serious about security. And that's a major problem. If you're going to have joint management of clear and present danger situations of wars, where you have members of Congress and you have the administration making decisions and checks and balances to some degree against each other, you got to have serious people who know something about war. I listened to Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia, like Elizabeth Warren. Yep. Here's someone who has, his words are so far removed from the reality of the type of attacks that you described, the type that have been going on. And clearly Iran was building up for it. The main trigger, both in June, but now in particular, because the Iranians still maintained a nuclear capability and they started to rebuild it.
Right.
Any nuclear weapons country like Iran, completely unstable, completely not just unpredictable, but based entirely on hatred, emotions, religion, ideology, it's a danger. You can use any language you want, clear and present, imminent, whatever the language is. It is a complete change in the ability of the United States to function. And we see some of the aspects of that now in terms of the oil, but with nuclear weapons, it would be far worse. It's interesting that every president, I don't remember how far back, maybe it was even back as far as Bush and Clinton, but certainly Obama, during the agreement, said, we will not allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. And Biden reinforced that, said the same thing. But they didn't do anything about it. On the contrary, they made a deal which nobody could really enforce or monitor, and which the Iranians obviously violated. And it gets back also not just the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but they said, okay, we're going to make you an easier package called the Joint Cooperative JCPOA. I forgot.
Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. There's one of those, anodyne little phrases that means absolutely nothing. There's nothing joint or comprehensive about.
And there was no treaty, by the way.
Right. It was an executive agreement. Never went to the Senate.
And the language of that, there was a version of it the Iranians put out in Persian. There was a version of it that was put out in English. Well, what's the one that counts? And there were differences between them. So you have an acknowledgement that nuclear weapons are bad if Iran gets them. And plus, we have the whole North Korea history. North Korea doesn't go around attacking its dangers. It's bad enough, but doesn't attack its neighbors. As you said, Iran's been attacking, and Iran's got this whole Middle East arc, what's called the Shiite arc, which went from Iran through Iraq and Syria all the way to Lebanon. It was threatening everything in the region. Syria is now not part of that, but it's just part of them being weakened after the June war, or maybe before that. It was actually before the June war, maybe, but being significantly weakened. But that's what the Iranian goal has been very clear. Again, death to America. So for all those reasons, the claim that you don't have to hold Iran to a very tight implementation of its agreements, and you can make a deal to soften them, also takes you far away from this concept of international law. Yeah, it's international law, but we're not going to enforce it in this case because it's too hard. So we're going to give it to them softer, and we'll give them a lot of money at the same time. That was the JCPOA. So right there, you're undermining international law. You're making exceptions because you can't really enforce it or implement it. It's just words.
Not that you can't, but that you don't you want won't. To. You yeah. won't. You won't. And that's the difference. Trump will. And again, I'm not talking about wisdom. I'm just talking about, we're talking about legalities. I do want to talk about non-proliferation in one sense, because you kind of edged up to this a little bit. I want to make sure that we get this explicitly. During my lifetime, during my adult lifetime, I guess I could say, I've seen three, maybe four nations go nuclear. I think Pakistan in the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken.
India went first.
India and then Pakistan. So four nations, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Iran close to it, right? India and Pakistan, that's a binary thing. It's a conflict between those two nations. They're not really threatening world domination but at least they're not threatening it. That was mostly in relation to each other. North Korea is a real problem because this is a guy who is a hereditary dictator, basically. It's his third generation of the Kims. But even that is probably manageable, even in the long run, because the Kim regime is interested in sustaining the Kim regime, right? He wants to pass it off, I guess, to his daughter, Ju Bae, I think is her name. It's there to control things, right? It's there to safeguard the regime. They've got 50 nukes. They're not going to win a nuclear exchange. They know that, but they also know that they're probably not going to have to get into one now because they have nuclear weapons. Iran is different. And this is what I've been trying to tell people. Iran's different because as nutty as Kim is, that's a rational policy towards a rational goal. And the rational goal is holding on to power. He's a cruel guy. It's a terrible regime. I'm not saying that anything different, but it's a rational policy towards a rational goal. For Iran, nuclear weapons are a rational policy towards a non-rational goal, not an irrational goal, but a non-rational goal. Their non-rational goal is theologic. They believe that Armageddon will produce the 12th Imam who will come in and allow Islam to take over the world.
And Shiite Islam, their particular brand of Islam.
Yeah, and not just Shiite Islam, but actually a particular sect of Shiite Islam. The 12th, there is a particular sect of Shiite Islam. That is why it's dangerous, much more dangerous to have nuclear weapons in the hands of the mullahs of Iran than it is, as dangerous as it is, to have it in Kim's hands in North Korea. And I'm not discounting the danger in North Korea, but the idea of mutually assured destruction still applies in North Korea. He understands that. Mutually assured destruction doesn't work with a nuclear-armed Iran because destruction is the point. That's not true in India or Pakistan. I look at it a little bit differently. Okay.
I look at it slightly differently, maybe because I'm probably older than you by a decade or more, and I remember the bomb. I grew up in San Francisco, and you know each parent had to sign. If there's a nuclear war, where do you want us to take your kids? That was frightening. Nuclear weapons are frightening.
I was at the very end of the duck and cover.
Okay,
era
so
in elementary okay. school, so I lived, was at the very end.
I
of
was
that.
Through the whole thing. And it was frightening, and there were lots of nuclear tests going on. It was a Cuban Missile Crisis. It was a lot of tension, and that was something people actually had to take into account, and as well as these psychological studies. But I'm going to put India and Pakistan for the reasons you said on the side. I think Clinton was wrong, and I said it at the time. Clinton should have taken action to prevent North Korea from becoming nuclear.
I do agree.
That was one of his major failures. And it's not discussed very much, but I think it should be out there. It also set the pattern. Well, they got away with it, so Iran can get away with it.
Yep.
You're right. I don't disagree with the analysis. They want to deter their neighbors. I won't say they don't threaten their neighbors, but they want to deter particularly Japan and South Korea. But they're not an aggressive colonialist, imperialist power, to use that language. Iran is. Iran keeps spreading its control, its power, its domination of the oil market, all those things. And we're seeing it constantly. So Iran isn't a different factor, but there's another aspect that North Korea, India and Pakistan never signed the non-proliferation treaty. India, Pakistan, and Israel as well. They were that the three programs, and Israel's never announced a capability, but it's generally conceived to have one for strictly defensive purposes. You can see why.
Right.
But especially this was now. Before, this was, these were three countries that were the exceptions to the non-proliferation treaty. If we want to get to the technical part, they didn't violate any international agreements.
Right.
North Korea kind of was in, kind of was out, and they did violate to a certain degree, but Iran was all the way in. Iran got help from the International Atomic Energy Agency. They said, we're going to sign this treaty, and therefore we're not going to develop nuclear weapons. Then we have this famous fatwa. Khamenei, the previous leader, said, we don't want to use nuclear weapons. We just want to use it for civilian power and other things, do the research. We're entitled to it. Well, and people took that seriously. Well, every day they were building closer and closer to testing weapons, building the warheads and everything else. They used the system. They clearly did it openly to exploit and use the system. And all these countries that pledge the importance of international treaties, international law, non-proliferation, they sat on their hands. Occasionally they would pass resolutions. There would be some sanctions which the Iranians knew how to get around. All of those things that took place. And then, of course, then we get again to the period of Obama and says, we're going to forgive you for all your previous violations. What kind of example is that? If this is something called, if it's a treaty-based international, they call it the rules-based international order. Well, Iran did everything it possibly could to violate that, and they made a deal with them and gave them a lot of money as part of the package. Yep. So people who come now and say, you know, you got to reinforce, you can't violate the rules-based international order, international law. These are the same people that played the games that did so much damage before. So I think that Iran is in a separate case also for that reason, not to mention the regime, the murderous regime and what they're doing to their own people and to the other peoples around.
Well, I will say this, Professor Steinberg. First off, I'm also from California originally. So, you know, Los Angeles, not San Francisco. But
all right. We still can talk.
We can still talk, right? We can. Yeah, I'm a Dodger fan. Maybe you were a Giant fan, but hey, you know, we can still. I'm sorry.
I still am.
Still am. Fan. Well, there you go. So, but we can still talk. We can still talk, and this is the way that people should be. But, I got a couple of minutes left. I want you to tell me what it's like in Israel right now. Right before we started recording, I was telling you I'd been to Israel a couple of times. Really love the people. There's a certain spirit in Israel that is really just admirable. And, you know, a lot of us are very concerned about how things are going over there for Israelis. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about your experience there and what's going on.
We've been targeted in a war for 4 weeks. And it's not the first time. There have been periods before that where Israelis were targeted by missiles. Goes back to, many of us remember, 1991 in the Gulf War when Saddam Hussein fired some missiles at us. This is different. It's much more intense. I think we had 8 or 9 missiles attacking central Israel so far today. Israelis all have shelters, some of them inside their houses, the newer places, some of them around a couple houses away. We do get, for most attacks, up to 10 minutes of warning because they get launched from Iran, so the radar picks them up. On the one end, that's very traumatic. You know, and the kids, I don't know how they're going to come out of this. I think people that I talk to, people that I see, my family is and others, it's part of being an Israeli. You got to be tough. You got to go through this and we'll have better times. There's also that optimism. We've been living not just with Iranian threats, but with Iranian mass terror. And Iran weaponized or supported, trained and supported Hamas with that terrible massacre that took place on October 7th, 2023. So we've been living with this fear. There is an optimism. I tend not to be that optimistic, even though I'm, as an Israeli, you kind of have to be, right? But that maybe this, after this war, we're going to have a long period of, if not peace, at least calm and not be threatened by these kinds of attacks. We've had attacks by missiles from Hezbollah, from Lebanon, from Hamas, from Gaza for at least 20 years straight. Maybe there's an optimism. I won't say there's an optimism that when this is over, and particularly because it's working with the United States so closely. Every Israeli thanks American forces for risking their lives. And we hear the planes flying over and sometimes we see them. And unfortunately, one crew member and a tanker crashed and I think six of the crew members died in an accident that took place. But they're out there every day. And that's hearing American planes and Israeli planes flying over protecting us is something that provides a tremendous sense of hope and support. We're not in this alone. We have the support of the world's greatest superpower. And even though the Europeans and others are all sitting on their hands, or even telling us we're doing something wrong, that this is going to make our world and maybe much of the world better. I don't know how this ends. And maybe it's not going to end happily ever after. Wars tend to get complicated. Right. But perhaps also, you know, I'll end on a positive note. I remember well, and you probably remember too, I think it was in 1987, Chernobyl blew up in the Soviet Union. And yes. There was mass casualties. It took 3 years for the Soviet leadership, that paper cutout government, to fall apart. But it was step by step. And when this war ends, and the Iranians see what's happened, and they regain their confidence, I still think that in 2 or 3 years, we're going to see a very different government. I know Iranians that I consider to be friends and colleagues, and most of them have left Iran. Some of them, you can occasionally get a note through, not for the last 6 months or so, 6 weeks, and they can build a really thriving society. It's not going to be one of those desert oil gas stations. So right. I'm also relatively optimistic about that. But it's not going to be through international law. It's going to be because when bad guys, when evil actors, when dictators and tyrants use force, they have to be met with force.
Professor Gerald Steinberg, I couldn't have put it any better. NGO Monitor president, NGO Monitor is, I'm trying to remember the URL, maybe you can.
Okay, it's ngo-monitor.org. And I just tell you in 30 seconds, when I started to look at all this stuff, is teaching international politics about 25 years ago, almost exactly. And I used to go to meetings of in the United Nations. It was actually guys, I was doing arms control, nuclear stuff. And there were people handing out brochures from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty with all sorts of propaganda on it. And I began to see they're at these meetings and they were considered to be respected international bodies that were listened to by UN officials. This was 25 years ago. I said, this is something nobody else is looking at. They have huge budgets. Human Rights Watch got $100 million a year. They have IRS tax exempt status. They're a political propaganda organization. They shouldn't be given that kind of privilege. And the same thing for Amnesty International and the other groups. So in a couple of sentences, and they all do the international fictions. They do the facades. Right. A lot of it comes from there. So that's closing the loop.
Well, go to ngo-monitor.org, and you can find out more about NGO Monitor. And Professor Steinberg, again, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us. I know it's a really difficult time for you and for everyone else in Israel, but our prayers are with you. And I hope that we will get a chance to get together again after all of this is over and talk about all the things that have improved as a result.
I thank you for a very interesting session. Thanks a lot. Look forward to seeing you.